You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 75, Leviticus 12 through 14. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good. Very good. We have three chapters to cover. It's a lot of material, a lot of strange stuff, but I think, you know, there's some things in here I think people will find interesting.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it.
Well, let's jump here into Leviticus 12. Of course, we'll just take these things in order, but all of these chapters are sort of related. We're going to get into essentially physical issues, things that happen to, you know, a person's body. I guess we'll try to make it as broad as we possibly can here, that result in ritual impurity. And I'll say at the outset that, I mean, none of these things have anything to do with sin, even though the purification solutions, you know, are going to bring up things like the sin offering, quote unquote, and the guilt offering, quote unquote. Well, we've tracked through the offering system already, and again, made a point to emphasize that a lot of that sort of thing is not about, you know, committing some, you know, moral act of impurity or some sin, but it's something that makes you unfit for sacred space. And we're going to get more of that today. And so when we talk about some of the offerings, you know, I'll be referring back to the terminology that, you know, I encourage us to think about. You know, sin offering is really a decontamination offering or a purification offering. The guilt offering, that's really a reparation offering, even though in the context that we'll talk about in this case, there's no reparatory sense to when it's used in regard to the skin diseases and all that sort of thing. But it's easy to look through an English translation, read these passages and think that, boy, you know, does God look at, you know, a woman having a child as like, is there some sort of moral impurity and, you know, sin with her? And you might think that's silly, but when you go to the New Testament and it talks about Mary bringing an offering after the birth of Jesus, I know many, you know, Protestants, you know, to try to take a jab at Catholics, you know, and I certainly don't believe in the sinlessness of Mary. She's like any other human being. But they'll say, well, look, you know, Mary had to bring an offering. You know, here she's, you know, this is an atonement offering in the Old Testament. So, of course, she was sinful and all, you know, it just misses the point totally. So it's not as odd or far-fetched as we might think, because you'll hear stuff like that and you'll read stuff like that that is just taken out of context. But anyway, let's jump in here to chapter 12. I'll read the whole chapter. It's just a few verses long. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days. As at the time of her menstruation, she shall be unclean. And on the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Then she shall continue for 33 days in the blood of her purifying. She shall not touch anything holy, nor come into the sanctuary. So that right away, you know, we can see this is about protecting sacred space from some sort of impurity. It's not, you know, having a baby is not a moral, you know, issue. There's no talk of sin here. She shall not come into the sanctuary until the days of her purifying are completed. But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks, as in her menstruation, and she shall continue in the blood of her purifying for 66 days. Again, we notice that these things are connected to menstruation, which of course is a loss of blood. We'll return to that thought in a moment. Verse 6, and when the days of her purifying are completed, whether for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting a lamb a year old for burnt offering, and a pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering, and he shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her. Then she shall be clean from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, either male or female. Notice that even though there's this disparate number of days that between bearing a son and bearing a daughter, you know, to be in this state of being ritually unclean, the solution for both is the same. It's exactly the same. So that should again give us a little clue that the unevenness in the days has nothing to do with the sort of more sinfulness of one child over the other, or that there's somehow inferiority going on, or a worseness going on with the female child as opposed to the male child, because the solution is exactly the same. Again, we'll get back to the disparity of days in a moment as well. So this is the law for her who bears a child, either male or female. And if she cannot afford a lamb, she shall take two turtle doves or two pigeons, one for a burnt offering, the other for a sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement for her. She shall be clean. She'll be made pure. She'll be made fit for sacred space again. Again, she hasn't sinned. That's the whole chapter right there. There's no talk about an offense, you know, a moral offense against God or anything like this. Again, we should be used to the dichotomy and that trajectory by now, having gone through the sacrificial language. So when you go through chapter 12, you know, the natural questions are, well, what, you know, what's the logic here? You know, why do we have this law? What's the rationale? Again, there's no association with sin or divine displeasure. Children obviously are considered a blessing throughout the Old Testament. Childbearing is always considered in high regard. You have passages like Psalm 128:3 that establish that, Genesis 24:60, a bunch of verses you could go to for the goodness of having children. You know, so why would Leviticus 12 then deem the postpartum woman to be unclean? And why the different number of days for uncleanness, you know, the total time unclean for a female child versus a male child? You know, what's going on here? Well, there are a couple of approaches. And again, I'm going to, you know, I'll just hit a couple things and sort of give you my take on all of this. I think this passage, again, is something that, you know, we'll, when we get to chapter 15, I'll be referring back to this and some other other chapters as well, because you can put this chapter and some of the material in other chapters under this whole, you know, really an umbrella question. Why do various, we'll just call them bodily discharges, make someone ritually unclean? Now here in this case, it's you're having a child and you bleed. In other words, the connection between the birth, the childbirth, is in the passage connected with her menstruation. And Israelite women were considered ritually unclean, ritually impure when they were, you know, having their period. And chapter 12 here connects that situation with this one. So the issue is a bodily discharge, not in terms of the child. That's not what the discharge is we're talking about, but the loss of what we might call life fluids, blood, in this case. You know, there's lots of blood that come out, you know, in childbirth. There's water. Again, I'm going to refer again to the pre-scientific nature, you know, again, of the context here, because personally, I think that has something to do with the disparate nature of the impurity periods. But, you know, there's, well, what, for lack of a better term, water and blood, you know, come out and all this kind of stuff, or liquids associated with childbirth. And to the Israelite, okay, this is a loss of whatever liquids there are that are important for producing life and sustaining life. So one approach is that this whole chapter and laws like it have to do with the loss of that which the life giver gave for life. That's one rationale. So there's this, again, loss of these important fluids, and that means a person is not whole. They're not sort of retaining the liquids that God has put in our body. Again, I'm speaking as a pre-scientific person here. We're losing that which God has given to us to produce life, which means we are not whole. We are not we are no longer as God made us to be. God is the life giver. He's given us this ability. He's given us these, you know, fluids within us to create and sustain life. And when we lose that, especially as it's connected with reproduction, that renders us, again, ritually unfit for sacred space. Because here's again, a related principle. The people who were not whole, for instance, if they had a handicap or they were missing an eye, missing a limb or something, there were limitations to their occupation of sacred space. And it's not because they're evil or God doesn't like them. It was to teach the point of the perfection of God, the wholeness of God. And so these situations, either a more permanent loss of something that made you whole or a temporary loss of something that made you whole, like childbirth, excluding that person from sacred space was designed to teach you, again, about the completeness of God and really the creation order. There's a lot that goes on in Leviticus that sort of honors the way God made things, and they're doing, you know, they're doing what they were created to do. Life is going on the way it was created to be lived, and the creation is functioning as God intended it to be. So there's this principle of wholeness, completeness, order, as opposed to chaos. Again, as opposed to disorder, and again, some sort of loss of life principle or violation of the good order that God created way back in Eden. So this is sort of the underlying logic, at least in this particular approach. So the point isn't to associate the new life, the child, with death or loss of life, but to associate the loss of the bodily fluids that make life possible and that God had given us to sustain life, you know, once we produce it. You know, and you could go back to Leviticus, or go forward to Leviticus 17:11, you know, the life of the flesh is in the blood. I mean, these sorts of ideas that they knew that there were certain things about the body that you couldn't, you know, just lose all your blood and still live. You lost enough of that, you're going to die. They knew, again, how babies, you know, were made through intercourse and when what happens in intercourse. So they had this sense that, again, there are things about the production of life and the maintenance of life that God has given us, that when we lose that, then things are not the way God, you know, originally intended them to be. Now, this loss is temporary. So you're temporarily unfit for sacred space. And so you have to wait a certain number of days, and then you have a ritual procedure that indicates you have indeed waited a certain number of days. There are offerings that are performed to make you fit for sacred space. None of this is about sin. Okay. It's about teaching the principle of sacred space, the completeness of God, that God is the life giver, all these big picture sorts of ideas. So again, when you have childbirth, again, there's this link in Leviticus 12 to, again, menstruation. If you read in Leviticus 15, again, we're going to hit that. You're going to have menstruation mentioned there. Again, you're going to have abnormal vaginal discharges. These things are going to be connected, so we'll be returning to some of these ideas, but here we are in Leviticus 12, just with the childbirth episode, and that's, again, one way to approach it. Now, some scholars bring up a problem here, and they'll say something like, not all loss of bodily fluid was considered impure, and that's true. For instance, there's no specific impurity legislation in the Holiness Code in Leviticus for things like breast milk or urine or sweat or pus or spit or vomit or anything like that. And so the reasoning goes, well, these are losses of bodily fluids as well. And, you know, so this approach about, you know, the incompleteness, you know, that childbirth produces in terms of bodily fluids is a bit wrongheaded. Well, I would say that on the one hand, you can't say that all, you know, loss of bodily fluids or even all loss of blood, like, you know, say you cut your finger, you get a bloody nose or something like that. Yeah, it's true that those don't render a person ritually impure or ritually unclean. The only ones that do, okay, the only ones that do are linked to childbirth and intercourse, which of course is linked to childbirth as well. So there's something about the loss of those particular body fluids. Again, looking at it from the using sort of the language of appearance, again, a pre-scientific, you know, mindset, what you see happening, what you know happens at intercourse and at childbirth. It's only the loss of those particular fluids in those particular contexts that make ritual impurity part of the discussion. And so I would say to that objection, well, you're correct. I mean, that is a legitimate objection, but you have to actually take a look at what is targeted to make sense out of it. And again, if you're thinking in terms of these are the components, if I could say it that way, there are certain, you know, again, parts of the way God made us to produce life and to maintain life, you know, semen, blood, you know, vaginal discharge and blood. I'm not going to get too far into this because in the ancient world, a female discharge or an orgasm by the woman was also considered to have input, or it contributed to conception. There are other places in the Bible where this becomes an issue, and there's Second Temple literature that makes this evident as well. We don't necessarily have that going on here, and we won't have it going on in Leviticus 15, but I bring it up just again for this idea that individual Israelites in antiquity knew what happened at intercourse, and they know what happens at childbirth. And so these particular laws reflect, again, the idea that the things that God has given us bodily, okay, to produce life and to maintain it, when we lose that, okay, we become not, we don't conform to the perfect order that God has created us with, that we have lost some of the life force. It has to be restored. God, we believe God will restore that and bring us back to wholeness if we wait a certain number of days, if we, you know, follow these procedures and so on and so forth, and then we'll be fit for sacred space, and that'll be a sign to us that we're back to being whole now, that sort of thing. So you have to think about it in those terms to have it make any sort of sense. Again, it's not our context. We don't think about these things this way, but in antiquity, this was a very natural way to think about things, and it's reflected in the Hebrew Bible here. The other approach, again, I've already hinted at it, and that is systemic natural order. I guess that's the label I'm using for it. So again, this is part of the bodily fluid thing, that what happens at intercourse, what happens at childbirth, what happens at menstruation, because that's part of the reproductive cycle, that this is the way our bodies should work. This is normal, natural order. If we want to skip ahead to Leviticus 15, you could say something like this. In Leviticus 15, right around verses 16 and 17, you have laws of about seminal emissions, okay? And so a seminal emission in the male, again, that has the normative function of impregnating a female and producing life. Again, this is how the ancient person would look at it. And so the reason that makes a person, a man, ritually impure is because it didn't happen during intercourse. Okay, it happened in some context where conception was an impossibility. And so that could be viewed as a dysfunction. In other words, it's not something, again, immoral or anything like that, but since it happens outside the normal procedure of creating life, okay, when it did happen, that rendered you ritually impure. It was just a reminder of the way things are supposed to function, the way God has made us, the way God has made nature and creation, and all these sorts of things. So in Leviticus, again, a seminal emission that occurs outside of sexual intercourse made you ritually unclean. There is no law in Leviticus that says when you conceive, you know, you become unclean at that point. But you know, you have these sort of telltale laws that try to take the sexual behavior and create sort of a framework, sort of a context for it. This is the way things should occur because this is how God has made us to create life and so on and so forth. So a lot of this thinking is not only about the loss of bodily fluids that contribute to creating life and sustaining life, but also the normativeness. Again, what I'm calling the systemic natural order of things. This is actually, and again, this is, I don't want to go down this road yet because we'll hit it in Leviticus eventually. This is actually the heart of the biblical, the negative biblical view of homosexuality, because you have sexual activity, sexual intercourse there that cannot produce life. And so when you did this intentionally for pleasure, as opposed to homosexuality was used in the ancient world often to humiliate people, men, and it was sort of like a violence or a punishment. But when you do it sort of willfully, voluntarily, in a substitutive sort of way for a heterosexual relationship, the reason it was viewed negatively is because it could not produce another life. And so it was sort of an act of death in that kind of thinking. You're doing this And there's no hope that you're going to conceive life. And this is why God gave us, you know, sex. This is why God gave us these things, you know, to create life and so on and so forth. So it's going to be part of this underlying argument that, and I'm going to use a phrase that a lot of listeners will have heard, creation order. Okay, there is something to that cognitive framework, that mental approach to creation in the Bible. It's very important, again, especially in an ancient culture, that we do things that honor creation order, and things that do not honor creation order, they're either, you know, criminalized or they become occasions for ritual impurity. Again, if there's no willful involvement here, like in Leviticus 15 with a seminal emission, well, there's what you have. You know, it's an involuntary sort of situation. So we're not going to criminalize involuntary behavior. It's natural. But again, to teach the principle that this occurred outside the framework of the normative creation order, the normative natural order, then there's something, quote unquote, amiss. And we have to rectify that by going through different ritual procedures, waiting a certain amount of days, and then we're restored to wholeness and we can occupy sacred space. So that, again, we don't think about these things at all this way. But again, for the ancient Israelite, this was very much a part of their worldview. So we have to, again, factor that in. And I think that becomes the context for a correct way to read this. Now, I want to read something from Levine's Leviticus commentary, because he brings another factor in here that people will find interesting that relates to the supernatural world, specifically what we would think of as the demonic world. And here's what Levine says about the uncleanness of a postpartum mother. So here's one more thing you can add. Levine says, although the new mother was a source of joy to the community and her new child a blessing, she generated anxiety, as did all aspects of fertility and reproduction in ancient society. The childbearing mother was particularly vulnerable, and her child was in danger too, since infant mortality, and frankly, the mortality of mothers, women who had given child, you know, birth to children, was widespread in pre-modern societies. I mean, lots of women died in childbirth. Lots of babies died, either in childbirth or shortly thereafter. You know, we know this even on into the 19th and 20th centuries. This was a big deal. So because of this, Levine says, by declaring the new mother impure, in other words, susceptible, the community sought to protect and shelter her. In other words, you kept an eye on her during her, you know, more during her period of impurity, because there's going to be some isolation involved. You have to make sure that, you know, she's doing what she needs to do and not, you know, doing what is forbidden to her. So there's naturally a little bit more attention thrown onto her. Levine continues, in ancient times, concern for the welfare of the mother and child was most often expressed as the fear of destructive, demonic, or anti-life forces. This fear is evident in other ancient Near Eastern texts contemporaneous with the biblical period. They are replete with incantations and spells against demons and witches who were thought to kill newborn children and afflict their mothers. It is reasonable to assume that similar anxieties were current among the ancient Israelites as well. And although biblical religion certainly did not permit magical spells and the like as the proper means for overcoming these perceived threats to life, it did provide ritual means as well as practical methods to accomplish for the Israelite mother and her community what magic was supposed to accomplish for a pagan, okay, for the pagan mother. So what Levine's saying here is true. I mean, there are just hundreds and hundreds of spells to ward off, you know, demons that would, you know, kill children during the night. You know, what we would think of as stillborn children, and we could come up with, you know, some medical reason or, you know, what happened clinically to the ancient person. I mean, this is the result of anti-life forces, you know, destructive, demonic anti-life forces, to use Levine's terminology here. And so there were all sorts of spells and incantations, things you did, you know, for children, for newborns, for mothers who had just given birth, to protect them against what were viewed as supernatural invasive forces, just waiting to just squelch life in terms of the newborn child and the mother who was vulnerable. And so Levine's point here is that, you know, you're not going to see that solution in a biblical theology, but the solutions that are there, again, the various rituals, the waiting periods, again, the attentiveness to what the woman can and can't do, where she can and can't go, that kind of thing. It provides, you know, some practical means to just, in a nutshell, keep an eye on her. Now, what about the disparate number of days? Male versus female child. So I'm going to quote Wenham here. He has a nice summary of this. When a baby is born, Leviticus 12, the mother is contagiously unclean for 1 or 2 weeks, as unclean as she is during her menstrual period. Again, we read that in Leviticus 12. It's more fully explained in Leviticus 15. Again, I've alluded to that a little bit. That's the passage about the menstruation. In the week following menstruation, Wenham continues, a woman was not only unclean in herself and unable to visit the sanctuary, but anyone or anything she touched became unclean as well. On the 8th day, a boy had to be circumcised, again, but the woman remained unclean in herself, though she would no longer pollute other people at that point. After the period of purification is over, 40 days for a boy, 80 for a girl, again, that's the total sum, the mother must bring a purification, or quote, you know, purification offering, what many translations unfortunately have as sin offering, and also a burn offering for renewed fellowship with God. So how do we approach, again, the number of days here? Well, I think it's fair to say that a lot of scholars with respect to the boy opt for this explanation, that the 7 days is sort of 7 days are attributed to the boy, because on the 8th day, the boy would be circumcised. And so the woman, if she gives birth to a boy, is allowed to be among other people so that she can see the circumcision of her own son. In other words, she wouldn't miss the event. And so that seems to be, again, for many, the logic behind the number of days for the boy. And for the female, for a baby girl, there's really no consensus to this. Some scholars would say that the child may be related, or this whole rule, the female child, the extended rule, may be related to the belief, again, that Levine talked about, in supernatural threats to newborns and their mothers. Female newborns may be under more threat, or it was thought that they needed more attention, more care, more spells if you're a pagan, because hostile forces, by killing her off, you know, would also, you know, might undermine her ability to conceive children later in life or something like that. So you'll read that. I actually think that I don't really buy that as an explanation for the boy. It does make sense about the circumcision. So I think there's probably something to that. But I think what we probably have here, or at least this needs to get on the table with, for the boy, the circumcision, I think there's probably a pre-scientific biological distinction going on here. Now, the rabbis talk about this, and I'm going to just quote Levine again, because he has a whole section on the rabbis trying to explain this. And Levine makes this comment that it was thought by the rabbis, the male embryo was thought to be completely formed in 41 days and the female in 81 days. Then he has a citation of some rabbinic, you know, commentary from the Talmud. That this view was current in the ancient Near East is supported by ancient sources, specifically Aristotle, who's a Greek source, but again, making the comment that would, you know, apply more widely than just, you know, himself as a Greek, but he's just reflecting on the way people thought in the ancient world. Aristotle held that the male was formed in 40 days and the female in 3 months, which is very close to the 80-day mark here in Leviticus. Hippocrates thought that the male was formed in 30 days and 42 for the female. So there's this disparity. I'll just stop at those two examples. There's a disparity in other literature, and the disparity is based upon the assumption, the belief. Again, there's nothing scientific about this, but the belief that a male, you know, one gender took this long essentially to be formed in the womb and be ready for birth, and the female took this long, you know, a different amount of days. And so that was why there was a disparity in any sort of thinking about how to respond to childbirth or how to treat, you know, a mother who had just given birth. So this, I think there's something to this as well, that the disparity in the number of days in Leviticus has nothing to do with what the cultures thought about the genders. Oh, this one's just closer to cleanness, closer to God. The male's closer to God than the woman. I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think it goes back to certain beliefs, again, pre-scientific beliefs about what happens in the womb with each gender. I think it that needs to be on the table, that it could actually be that simple. But again, with the boy, it also does make sense, you know, to have at least the mother able to witness the circumcision of her own child, and so that there would be a restriction, you know, for the first part of the impurity period, you know, to the 7 days there. So again, there's no consensus on all of that. But again, those are the two things I think belong on the table. I think the circumcision does play a role, and then again, the pre-scientific beliefs about what happens in the womb, I think, needs to be on the table too. So let's shift to Leviticus 13 and, you know, 14. 13 is dealing with skin diseases, what we commonly think of as leprosy. Chapter 14 carries on the discussion about skin diseases and what to do about them, and also quote-unquote skin diseases in houses and other objects. So we want to say something about these two chapters. Let's just read the first 8 verses of Leviticus 13. It says, "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when a person has on the skin of his body a swelling or an eruption or a spot, and it turns into a case of," this is the ESV now, "a case of leprous disease on the skin of his body, then he shall be brought to Aaron the priest or to one of his sons the priests. And the priest shall examine the diseased area on the skin of his body. And if the hair in the diseased area has turned white, the disease appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it is a case of leprous disease. When the priest has examined him, he shall pronounce him unclean. But if the spot is white in the skin of his body and appears no deeper than the skin, and the hair in it has not turned white, the priest shall shut up the diseased person for 7 days. And the priest shall examine him on the 7th day. And if in his eyes the disease is checked, and the disease has not spread in the skin, then the priest shall shut him up for another 7 days. And the priest shall examine him again on the seventh day, and if the diseased area has faded and the disease has not spread in the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. It is only an eruption. And he shall wash his clothes and be clean. And if the eruption spreads in the skin, after he has shown himself to the priest for his cleansing, he shall appear again before the priest, and the priest shall look. And if the eruption has spread in the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a leprous disease. So those are the first 8 verses. ESV, even though it translates this leprous disease, there's a footnote in the ESV translation that says leprosy was a term for several skin diseases. What we have here, the Hebrew word is tsara'at, is not leprosy as it is known medically in the modern world. So what we have in the first few verses here, there's some sort of swelling, some sort of discoloration of the skin. Again, if the afflicted person suspects he must go to the priest, then, you know, he goes, you know, and it's the priest who determines whether he's unclean or not. And that, you know, we just read the passage. So you have a priest here. Okay, this is not a doctor. It's not even an ancient doctor. It's a priest, which should be one clue, again, to tell us that since this is a concern of the priest, this has something to do not with, again, medical practice and diagnosis and medical principles for us today and all that kind of stuff. It has to do with ritual impurity, ritual uncleanness. In other words, unfitness to occupy sacred space. So let's talk a little bit about what is actually going on. Tsara'at, again, skin disease, that's how I'm going to translate that, is actually not, again, leprosy as we know it in the modern world. And you'll actually find rabbinic commentary that understood this. They understood, again, in early modern period, what would eventually be called leprosy. The term for it today is Hansen's disease. They understood that what the Leviticus was talking about wasn't that. It was something else. So this is not something totally new, you know, in the wake of modern medicine. It's actually been a distinction known before, again, what we think of as modern medicine. The discrepancies, again, really are between skin disease and an ESV translation or any other translation using a term like leprosy. The discrepancy there is really due to translation tradition. The Septuagint, actually the Greek word used in the Septuagint for tsara'at, skin disease, is lepra. And lepra in Greek is just a generic skin disease. That's all it was. So even back as far as the Septuagint, they understood, again, this is a term you would use for a variety of skin conditions and not just what would later, again, be identified as, I guess, what we would call true leprosy. So let's talk about leprosy a little bit. Hansen's disease, again, is the modern name for this. Hansen's disease, true leprosy, mutilates people. It disfigures people. Your skin turns lumpy. Your eyeballs are glazed. You can lose digits, fingers, and toes. Let me just read you a clinical description of leprosy. Hansen's disease is primarily a disease of the skin and peripheral nerves. It is of two kinds, tuberculoid and lepromatous. 20% of leprosy victims develop the lepromatous form, which is characterized by skin lesions that appear over most of the body. The skin of the forehead and face thickens, with natural lines becoming exaggerated, and loss of facial hair can occur. In the tuberculoid form, single skin lesions and loss of feeling in the affected area are the usual early symptoms. Now, leprosy is contagious. Hansen's disease is contagious, but it's not highly contagious. Another, back to the clinical definition here, quote, transmission of the infection actually requiring prolonged and close contact. That's the section, and we read, the bacteria appear to spread from the skin and nasal mucosa of those suffering from leprosy, but the exact portal of entry is not known. Although there is no conclusive evidence, the respiratory tract seems to be the most likely means of contracting the disease. Skin, especially broken skin, is also a possible source of infection. So that description has quite a number of disconnects with what we're reading here in Leviticus 13. Just as a point of trivia, modern leprosy treatment started in about the 40s. It's treated with antibiotics now, and there are certain surgical techniques that have allowed people suffering from Hansen's disease, true leprosy, to live fairly normal lives and avoid the extreme isolation. So it is treatable. Again, antibiotics are probably the most effective way of treating it. It certainly wasn't, hey, the hair on your skin turned white. You know, again, this what you read in Leviticus 13, where it basically the priest diagnoses someone as having tzara'at and then isolates them, and maybe 14 days later it'll go away. Again, this is not what real leprosy does, and this has been known for quite some time. So biblical tzara'at doesn't really align with these symptoms of true leprosy. The only really real thing tzara'at has in common with Hansen's disease is that it's a skin problem. Okay? Methods of diagnosis are different. There's no allusion in Leviticus 13 to hideous facial or digit deformity, loss of digits, nerve damage, rotting of parts of the body. There's nothing like that. So the description here and the diagnosis does not align with true leprosy. Now, what about the description? If we go to Leviticus 13, 18 through 23, we get a little bit more. If there is in the skin of one's body a boil and it heals, and in the place of the boil there comes a white swelling or reddish white spot, then it shall be shown to the priest. And the priest shall look, and if it appears deeper than the skin and its hair is turned white, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a case of leprous disease that has broken out in the boil. But if the priest examines it and there's no white hair in it, it is not deeper than the skin, but is faded, then the priest shall shut him up for 7 days, and so on and so forth. So what we read there, again, is there's some sort of skin problem going on. There's actually no explanation for how it happens. In other words, the causes are sort of taken for granted. They're not given in Leviticus 13. It's just something that happens. The person pronounced unclean is isolated outside the camp, because that person could well pollute others. Again, the isolation is ultimately about protecting sacred space. We don't want this infected person to make someone else ritually impure, and then that person may not know it, may wander into sacred space, and boy, now we have a problem. So we isolate this person. The unclean person has to tear their clothes. They leave their hair. You know, we're not going to read all the whole passage, but they have to tear their clothes. They leave their hair unkempt. They're supposed to cover the lower part of their face and warn others to stay away by shouting unclean, all that sort of thing. It's interesting that the torn clothes and the covering of the face and leaving your hair all crazy, that those are part of mourning rituals. Remember when someone died, you tear your clothes, you know, tear your hair out, that kind of thing. We see this elsewhere in the Old Testament. These are signs of mourning someone's death. Well, in this case, it's like the person that has the skin disease is mourning his or her own death. They're like, you know, I hate to even bring it up, they're like the walking dead, okay? I mean, that's just the way they're looked at, and really the way they're supposed to consider themselves. And it's not that they're going to die. I mean, if you read through Leviticus 13, this isn't something where you're going to drop over dead or this is going to kill you. Again, that's another disconnect from Hansen's disease, because if you lose enough flesh, I mean, this could be serious. It could be fatal. But what it meant was that they would have to be permanently cut off from the Israelite camp, from sacred space, from the priesthood. They are permanently cut off from the blessings of the covenant. And so the mourning rituals sort of make sense, because it's a life blessed by the true God was effectively made impossible if you had this disease and if you were permanently isolated by it. So this is, again, another indication. This is when the person is healed, or when it looks like they're not really, they don't have leprous disease, but it's something else. They perform the ritual of cleansing to be readmitted to the community. I mean, it's not, again, that they're being forgiven for sin, or, you know, God's, you know, sending the leprosy there because they've sinned. There's nothing like that. What the cure is, the quote-unquote cure, again, this has nothing to do with medicine. The cure is to let you live among God's people so that you can, again, partake of the blessings of the covenant. It's religious in nature. It's ritual. It's about sacred space and being part of the covenant community. Now, in Leviticus 14, we get a discussion of the treatment, and if I'm using that word lightly, sort of with a grain of salt, because it isn't a medical treatment. It's a ritual that is done to restore the person to community fellowship. Again, it has nothing to do with actual medicine. Wenham, in his Leviticus commentary, summarizes it real nicely, so I'll read a little bit from him. He says, if a man thinks they have recovered from the skin disease, the priest is summoned to examine him. Now, this is the first few verses, or first part of Leviticus 14. If the priest agrees that the man is cured, two clean birds are brought. One has to be killed and its blood caught, you know, captured, put in a container, and mixed mixed with fresh water contained in an earthenware vessel. Some of it is sprinkled over the man using cedar wood, scarlet cord, and hyssop. The living bird is also dipped into the blood and then allowed to fly away free. Then the man himself must shave all over and wash himself in his clothes. He is then clean enough to re-enter the camp, but not to live at home yet. Again, this has no medical value to it. It's all ritual. It's about ritual restoration. Wenham continues and says, these rituals are termed by anthropologists rites of aggregation. In other words, ceremonies in which a person who is in an abnormal social condition, here they're isolated, is reintegrated into ordinary society. Shaving, washing, offering sacrifice are regular ingredients of such rituals. The shaving and washing obviously portray cleansing, sort of like an illustration, an object lesson of cleansing from the pollution caused by the skin disease and the life of uncleanness implicit in having to dwell outside the camp. Dipping the one bird in the blood of the other and sprinkling that blood on the worshiper is an action that at least establishes a visible relationship between the worshiper and the birds, between the worshiper and the sacrifices, this ritual, between the worshiper and the ritual. The bird let loose in the open country is a symbolic representation of release from the disease. Now, you notice that the birds used are clean birds. You know, they're ritually clean. You know, the whole list of clean and unclean animals. So the birds used are ritually clean. So that's important. The blood water mixture is a ritual cleansing agent. Again, it's to visually convey the idea of cleansing. Again, they're ritual acts and not medical acts. Now, what about the restoration? Let's just look in Leviticus 14, 1-9. Let me find that real quickly and read a little bit of that. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, this is shall be the law of the leprous person for the day of his cleansing. He shall be brought to the priest. Then we have this ritual with the birds. Two live clean birds. Okay, the priest shall command one to be killed. The other one is dipped in the blood, so on and so forth. Verse 8, he who is to be cleansed shall wash his clothes, shave off his hair, bathe himself in the water. Seventh day he shall shave off his hair from his head, his beard, his eyebrows, everything. He shall shave off all his hair and shall wash his clothes. And on the eighth day he shall take two male lambs without blemish, one ewe lamb, a year old without blemish, and a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah, so on and so forth. The priest who cleanses him shall set the man who is to be cleansed in these things before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And the priest shall take one of the male lambs and offer it for a guilt offering. Of course, we have a whole list of offerings. Sin offering around verse 12, verse 13. So what happens is, initially the person is cleansed through the initial ritual that Wenham talked about, that he summarized, so that they can rejoin the community. And then on the eighth day, okay, that's after 7 days. On the eighth day, the priest brings him right to, you know, the edge of sacred space. And then again, some offerings are performed. And that signifies, okay, now you're sort of graduating from being allowed in the community. And now you are going to be cleansed. You're going to be made fit again for sacred space. So all of it, the whole procedure, again, is about being fit for, you know, to occupy, to tread on, you know, to participate in sacred space. Again, there are elements here also found in Leviticus 16, which is the Day of Atonement. It's kind of interesting about the sprinkling of blood. In Leviticus 14, the blood of the bird is sprinkled 7 times over the worshiper, and the priest declares him clean. In Leviticus 16, the blood of the second goat is sprinkled onto the mercy seat. So there's actually a ritual connection between what happens here and what happens in Leviticus 16, where the priest, you know, is quote unquote making atonement for the whole nation. Again, it's just another connection that shows that what's happening in Leviticus 14 to the person who's suffering from the skin disease is about sacred space. It's not about sin. It's not about medicine or anything like that. Now, what about the rationale? What does all this mean as we wrap up here? I think it's clear, again, I've said it over and over again, might as well just say it one more time, Leviticus's laws and rituals are about marking sacred space and maintaining the sanctity of that space, protecting the presence of God from impurity. Okay, this is why you isolate people. This is why people, you know, have to go through some of the sacrifices and offerings we read about earlier, so that, you know, God can look at them and they are quote unquote atoned for, not in the sense that they've committed a sin, but they are made right in God's eyes to participate in sacred space, you know, as much as they're allowed to, you know, bringing offerings to the priest. And of course, you know, there are limitations for how far the normal person can walk and all that kind of stuff. But that's what these offerings are about. For order to be restored, again, the balance, you know, because Leviticus and the sacred space idea is really about the balance between space that is sacred and space that isn't. Again, to sort of keep that balance, restore it. Again, the violator or the offender, the person who's afflicted, again, has to be made correct through these rituals. If they resist them, they don't want to do them, or they neglect them, again, that's going to impair a right relationship between God and that person and you know, frankly, God and his people. You know, we've seen other people suffer for not doing, you know, back to Nadav and Avihu in Leviticus 10, not doing things the correct way. That affects the whole community. So to be in right relationship to God in terms of his presence, you got to do these things. But why was a person with skin disease a threat to sacred space? Why do they have to be removed? I mean, you can't really help this. You know, you get a skin disease. Okay. Well, it's kind of the same thing as in Leviticus 12. You can't really help childbirth either. You know, you get pregnant, you're going to have a child. You know, you're going to lose, you know, semen and intercourse, Leviticus 15. These things just happen. And again, that's actually partially the point. There's no sin here involved in the skin disease in Tzara'at. Now, it's a mistake to take instances like Miriam in Numbers 12, the house of Joab in 2 Samuel 3. There's the Gehazi incident, Elisha's servant in 2 Kings 5. They're all struck with leprosy because of some sin they commit. In Leviticus, that is not the case. You read Leviticus 13 and 14, there is no association with sin with this disease. Again, whatever the Tzara'at is. It's never characterized that way. Now, in the view of the priestly material here, none of these events, childbirth, genital discharge, corpse contact, skin disease, none of it is about sin. And I think it's important to mention Numbers 5:2 in this regard. I'll just read you that one verse. Numbers 5:2, God says, "Command the people of Israel that they put out of the camp everyone who is leprous or has a discharge, or everyone who is unclean through contact with the dead." Okay, bodily discharges, contact with the dead, and the skin disease are all lumped into that one verse. And again, none of them are inherently unnatural. None of them are about sin. They're all natural and largely unavoidable. Again, skin disease is put in the same bucket. So the rationale for it has nothing to do with God being displeased. I think the issue, again, just as we saw with Leviticus 12, it's an issue of imperfection. It's an issue of not being whole, of not being the way God made you, that there's something wrong, there's something amiss with your body, either in terms of its function or, and again, they're bringing up other examples here, like blindness or loss of a limb or something like that. They're, you know, physical handicaps. People are excluded from sacred space when there's something amiss about their wholeness as a person, which involves their body. And again, the idea is not to condemn that person. The idea is to teach positively the perfection, the completeness of God, and the original creation order that is the ideal. Because this is what God is going to be associated with. He's going to be associated with Eden. Okay, the sacred space of the tabernacle. Again, think back to, you know, we talk about cosmic mountain and divine council worldview and all this kind of stuff. This plays a part in it because what's going to be associated with God is wholeness and perfection. Where God lives, his abode, the space that is marked off as his, must be associated with life and not death, with wholeness, not incompleteness, with the ideal embodied life in its ideal form versus embodied life of humanity in less than ideal form. Again, it's about teaching a distinction between the perfection of God, the perfection of God's abode, the perfection of where God is, and your world. Okay, your world is a little less than perfect. You need to be reminded of that. And this, you know, since it doesn't have anything to do with sin, it doesn't have anything to do with your spiritual commitment to Yahweh, your loyalty to Yahweh. Again, the hope of the Old Testament person is that upon death, that they will be with the Lord. They will be in his presence. So that hope doesn't go away. That it doesn't disappear. It's not impaired in any way. But life in this physical world, life in the embodied world, is never going to be all that it could be in relationship to the perfection of God. And so these conditions of impurity, these conditions of lesserness, of incompleteness, unwholeness, are designed to teach that idea, to teach the distinction. And so that, I think, is you know, what we can sort of glean from these chapters. We might as well just throw Leviticus 15 in here because there was so much of it there. But it's a reverence for creation order. It's a reverence for God's perfection. It's an acknowledgement of being lesser, of being imperfect, of not being able to attain or sustain or maintain the kind of life that is associated with the very presence of God. So it's reverence for creation order, reverence for life itself. We should respect life and the normativity of life as it was designed by the Creator. When we don't, we put that at threat, not that we're stronger than God, but God can withdraw from us. God might punish. God might leave. God might, do something that puts an obstacle between you, the offender, or the violator, especially if it's some sort of deliberate resistance, to doing what you need to do, and, your status as being loyal to Yahweh, your salvation. Again, couching that in Old Testament terms, loyalty to Yahweh alone, and not having another God or no God at all. So when you don't, again, observe these things, you align yourselves with the forces of chaos, with the forces of dysfunction. You resist. Again, the will of the true God, who has somehow, for some reason, and Deuteronomy says just because he loved you, made a covenant relationship with you. So why are you dissing that? Why would you? Again, these are the big picture ideas, I think, that come across when we think about passages like Leviticus 12 through 14, again, throwing chapter 15 in there, that we can take away and think about. It's just something good for us to think about. Our respect for life and creation order and the normativity of life as it was created, and also the utter otherness of God.
Okay, Mike, on Leviticus 12, 6 through 8, could you just touch on it again that when a woman does bear a child, that her sin offering is not technically a sin for atonement.
Right. There's no, it goes back to the quote, the kata'at, the sin offering material we talked about earlier in Leviticus, that offering was a purification offering. We talked about the word itself, that there's a homograph issue. Kata'at can mean sin. Kata'at, the homograph, has to do with purging from contamination, again, being decontaminated, that sort of thing. So the woman who gives birth has been made ritually impure, ritually unclean. And so that offering is, again, done in the prescribed way after the number of days and all that stuff. When the woman brings that offering and that offering is performed, she then can have confidence that God will accept her into sacred space again, that there's nothing amiss here between her fitness to approach God any longer.
Yeah, I just know some people, Christians, are getting hung up that having a kid is a sin and whatnot. So I know that's a
miss. But again, it's used that way because of Mary. I think in a misguided attempt to poke Catholic theology in the eye, they'll go back to this language in Leviticus and not really understand that the quote unquote sin offering is about decontamination. It's not about moral forgiveness for some moral impropriety.
Well, all right, Mike, we appreciate that. Well, I don't think we spoke about it in our last podcast, but Supernatural, the official launch, is underway. So it's technically official, isn't it?
It is technically official. The official launch date was November 10th. If you do get Supernatural and read it, please post a review. Reviews, help draw attention by other reviewers. And it sort of lets us know if we hit the mark or if we didn't. I mean, you can't always tell that if people get it. We need to know if we did a good job or not, in terms of what we were trying to do. So that helps to see reviews. But, spread the word on social media. And I think if you go look at the reviews now, one thing that becomes evident is a lot of people do feel that this is a book that they can give to new Christians or people who are totally unfamiliar with, what we call around here the Divine Counsel worldview. If you're totally unfamiliar with that or you know someone who is, this is a good way to get them into that content. Despite the fact that Unseen Realm is very readable, it's also very dense with lots of footnotes and all that kind of stuff. So if you know someone who is used to just reading lighter material and you want to get them into this content, to get them excited about it, you go up and read the reviews on Amazon, it apparently is hitting that mark, at least with the people who reviewed it, which is why I'm encouraging reviews. I want to feel like, yeah, you know, that it served its purpose. You know, that's what I want to see.
Yeah, it's a super easy read. I think I finished it in 2 days. I mean, it's a very quick and easy to understand read. So it's a great job on compacting that content into such a...
It was an interesting exercise to produce it. And I'll admit, you know, I'd not done anything like that before, taking that material, that kind of material, and condensing it. Because it's even sort of aimed at folks who have less Bible under their belt than the people who would normally traffic my blog. So, we were trying to, again, shoot for the new Christian, the person who sort of equates Bible study with just Bible reading. I mean, they're not real, into it. Can we hit that mark? And so I wasn't sure. You know, that's, again, why I want to see the interaction.
And Mike, you just got back from Ohio. And how'd that go?
It was fun, a lot of fun. Janine and Oscar were my hosts, and they did a great job of organizing it. It's a lot of work, and I know it's a lot of work. There were 120, 130 people. They sold tickets, to pay for a lunch that was catered. So we know that's how many were there. It was a good attendance. There were good questions. Signed a lot of books. It was really nice to hear, people again say, "Boy, we like the podcast."
Yeah, that's good.
You have fans out there, Trey. Don't let that go to your head. But you got plenty of fans. It's just nice to know that people are paying attention, to it. It was just a good time. So I'm certainly glad we're doing that sort of thing, and look forward to doing, to being at other places too. I like to meet people that care about the material.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's what I view my audience as. It's not, I'm trying to get people interested in their Bible, even though supernatural, that is the goal. But when I think about what I do and what I want to spend my time on, as I've said here on the podcast many times, it's really about people who just have a sense that there must be more to the Bible than what I've been taught, or I feel like I'm missing something and I have this or that question. That's sort of where I view my role as being. And so you get to meet people like that, and it's affirming. It makes a difference.
Yeah, and we have a big, week coming up. So tell them what you're doing and where you're going.
Well, it's November, which the week before Thanksgiving is always the annual time for the academic conferences in religion and biblical studies. This year it's in Atlanta, and there'll be anywhere from probably 8,000 to 12,000 people at different conferences. They all tend to piggyback over each other. So the week opens with the Evangelical Theological Society annual meeting, and then the ASOR, American Schools of Oriental Research. That's the archaeology and ancient Near East crowd. SBL, Society of Biblical Literature. AAR, American Academy of Religion. IBR, Institute for Biblical Research. They all sort of congregate for 1 week at one place at the same time. And it's a crazy week because there are literally thousands of papers that you could go to. That's how big it is. It's a sprawling event. And for our company, it's the big event of the year to sell product. But for me personally, I'm not in the booth unless I'm talking to someone about this or that. But it's great just to go hear things and to connect with friends and whatnot. So this year I'm going to try to preserve some of those conversations so that you can sort of, listeners can get an idea of, who's at these events, what do people talk about, why do they go, what do scholars do. So it won't be scholars gone wild, but it'll be scholars who are less boring or less bored or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a geek fest for biblical studies and religious studies.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. We're going to try to, we may have one or two or maybe three shows come out of that, depending upon how long y'all talk and conversations go.
Who we can capture, who we run into. I'll try to record as much of that as I can.
That's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. Want to give people an idea of what this thing, who's there, what it's like a little bit.
All right, Mike. Well, I've got a challenge for our listeners. Since this is going to be the only show before Thanksgiving, I want to challenge our listeners to tell at least three people at Thanksgiving about the show and Heiser's books, because Mike, this is when all the families are getting together and it's a good time to talk about just reconnecting with your family. So I want to challenge people just to tell three of their family members or people during the Thanksgiving day or week and expose them and talk to them and be the foot soldier of spreading Mike's work and the show and whatnot. So I'd like to do that, Mike, and see if we can't get more people listening and more people reading and participating.
That's we'll add that to the list of reasons why I'm glad you're here, Trey, because I never would have thought of that. Just that's a really people. Good idea.
Yeah, because I know my family. I've already passed your books around. I got people talking about it, whatnot. So I know I'm seeing family members that I haven't seen in a while. So I plan on saying, hey, I'm doing this podcast show. You know, usually like, what? You know, so it's a good time to expose people to new ideas and just, you know, nothing else to talk about. So you might as well talk about the Bible, right?
Yep, yep.
It's a good time. All right, Mike. Well, I guess, is there anything else that you would like to discuss or talk about for this show?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, well, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast, and I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, and for those yep. who aren't celebrating Thanksgiving, I guess, have a happy week. All right, thanks for listening. God bless.
Yep.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.